was Lori Quint, found in a redoubt in Alaska and rescued from the dysfunctional family of a father that used her as a toy for his own gratification, rescued only for her to perish along the way. But if she was truly dead, then how could she have come to be here in front of him, taunting him like this? Suddenly, Doc was no longer afraid. He knew he wasn't trapped under a wagon in the West. He wasn't in his own time. In fact, he had no time to call his own. He had long since left Emily, Rachel, and Julian behind. They had led their lives, lived out to whatever brief span, without ever knowing what had happened to him. How could they? How could 19th century gentlefolk ever comprehend the perverse science behind Operation Kronos? That part of the totality concept that had snatched Doc from his own time and propelled him into the 1990s, before his dissension and desire to return to his own time had forced his captors to send him into a future that, ironically, had preserved his life. For while he had leapt over the nuclear holocaust known in this new time as Skydark, those very scientists whose totality concept had helped form it had perished. And in that dark new world of the Deathlands, Doc had met Lori and lost her. But despite it all, despite the physical strain of being propelled through time, despite the mental torment that often made him feel as though he had descended into insanity, he had survived. He and the ones he traveled with, his true companions, on a journey that wasn't yet over.
Oh, very well. Do what you must. Just get this unreality over with.
Lori Quint nodded blankly and walked over to the wheel, poised over Doc's chest.
Sorry, Doc.
She began to push the wheel down, gently at first, but then with more force, the effort showing on her face.
It doesn't matter. It just...
Doc's ability to speak was taken from him by the rush of pain. Doc looked up into Lori's face as the periphery of his vision grew dim, the black edges spreading inward.
It just has to carry on.
Then all darkened, and the pain grew to encompass the darkness. Doc looks in a pretty bad way. Ryan Carter hunkered down beside the older man, whose white, straggling hair was matted in sweat-soaked strands to his head. He was stretched out on the floor of the Matran's chamber, his limbs jerked in spasm, and his open eyes rolled up into his skull. Doc was always Ryan's main concern on arriving at a new destination. The Matran's chambers were located in secret pre-dark U.S. Army redoubts that were dotted across the ruins of America and the lands now known as the Deathlands. None of the fellow travelers knew how to program the computer-triggered matter transfer machines that were at the heart of each base. They knew only that closing the door triggered the mechanism and set the old comptech working that was left in the depopulated bases. Each jump was a gamble. The vast land and weather upheavals that had followed the long night of Skydark had changed the geography of the old Americas irrevocably, so there was always the risk that they would land in a Matran's chamber that was crushed beneath tons of rock, or flooded so that they would instantly drown. So far, they had been lucky. Either that, or the automatic default settings on the remaining working comps would only transfer at random to redoubts where the chambers were still able to receive. But that wasn't something that Ryan could assume. The redoubts offered them a way to move vast distances across the scorched earth. However, everything had its price. Although it gave them an advantage that few, if any, could share, it also carried its own cost. The jumps were a nightmare experience, where every atom of their being was torn apart, flung across vast distances, and then reassembled. It made them all feel as though they had been ripped slowly apart, each sinew stretched to the snapping point, all organs squeezed tightly in an iron grip, and gave them a worse hangover and comedown than the strongest shine or jolt. Some of the group adapted to the jump better than others, and it seemed to be something genetic rather than just fitness and strength. Although the fact that Ryan was always the first to stir after a jump could lead to that initial conclusion, for he was the most obviously physically fit specimen in the group. He stood more than 6 feet tall, with a mane of waving dark curls that framed a square-jawed and handsome face that was only somewhat marred by the patch that covered the empty left eye socket. The livid and puckered scar that ran down his cheek bore testimony to the manner in which the eye had been lost. The one-eyed man was a fighting machine, his whipcord musculature developed by years of action. Hearing a murmur behind him as he crouched over Doc, Ryan turned to find his son Dean regaining consciousness and rising to his feet. Just as his father had checked the razor-sharp Panga strapped to his thigh and the 9mm Sig Sauer P226 pistol and Steyr SSG-70, so Dean automatically checked and holstered the 9mm Browning High Power that was his preferred blaster. Apart from his two functional eyes, Dean could have been a mirror image of his father. Now, 12 years old, the boy was developing into a fighting machine that would one day be the equal of his old man. Ryan looked away from his son and back to Doc.
Doc looks bad.
I know. Mildred should be conscious soon. Maybe she'll be able to do something.
Christy Roth was also beginning to stir from the stupor brought on by the Matrans jump. She groaned as she raised her head, her long fur coat wrapped around her shapely and finely muscled body, tendrils of her Titian hair uncurling and flowing freely as she felt the danger recede. Christy's hair reflected her ability to sense danger, and her muty senses were trusted by Ryan in tight spots. The woman rose to her feet. Without pausing, she checked her .38 caliber Model 640 Smith & Wesson, holstering it as she strode the short distance to where Ryan and Dean were hunched over Doc. By now, Dr. Mildred Wyeth was coming around, as was J.B. Dix. As usual, the pair made the jump side by side, their hands touching. Neither was the type to show his or her emotions, but each would die for the other. Mildred's dark skin was nearly ashen with the shock of the jump, her breathing labored but regular, and her beaded plaits shook around her downturned face as she tried to clear her head.
Shit. I never used to get hangovers that bad. That's the worst jump I can remember for a long, long time.
I'll second that.
JB's lean, almost gaunt face was set in an expression of intense discomfort, broken only by the out-of-focus set of his eyes. His bony hand reached for the wire-rimmed spectacles he kept securely in his jacket pocket during jumps. Placing them on the bridge of his nose, he blinked as his still-clouded eyes adjusted to consciousness. Where Mildred carried a generous covering of flesh on her frame, JB was wiry and thin, belying his strength and stamina. Known as the Armorer, JB had met Ryan when they traveled together as Sekhmen for the Trader, the legendary figure who was foremost among the breed of traveling merchants who kept alive what little economy and trade could exist, sniffing out caches of pre-dark supplies and using them for barter. JB was an armorer by trade and natural inclination, his fascination and thirst for knowledge of all weapons matched only by his ability to get the best out of even the most neglected and damaged blaster. He rose to his feet, dusting himself down out of habit, even though there was no dust in the static-free atmosphere of the chamber. Bending, he picked his battered fedora from the floor and placed it on his head, not feeling properly dressed until I was done. He then checked his Techna knife, his M4000, and his Uzi that were his preferred blasters and trusted companions. Beside him, Mildred had also risen to her feet and checked her own blaster, the .38 caliber Checkmade ZKR-551 target pistol. Although not the most powerful of the hand blasters that had run through the hands of the companions during their time roaming the Deathlands, it suited Mildred perfectly, being the model she had used in her days as an Olympic-grade shooter. For Mildred was, like Doc Tanner, a relic of the past, who should not by rights have been alive in the Deathlands. She had spent Christmas of the year 2000 in hospital for routine surgery on a suspected ovarian cyst. While under anesthetic, Mildred had developed complications that saw her vital signs sinking fast, with no apparent way to revive her. She was cryogenically frozen until this seemingly minor problem could be solved. Ironically, it was the act of dying that kept her alive, for while she was frozen, the superpowers executed the military and nuclear maneuvers preceding Skydark and the resultant nuclear winter that created the landscape of the Deathlands. When Ryan and his traveling companion stumbled across the facility where her frozen body was stored and managed to successfully revive her, she found herself in an incomprehensibly different world from the one she had left behind. Unlike Doc, whose body and mind had been prematurely aged and weathered as a result of being flung through time, Mildred had kept a grasp on reality and adapted well to the harsh new world. Her medical skills were sometimes blunted by the lack of resources, but her knowledge had proven invaluable to the band of travelers in even the most exceptional circumstances. Mildred's first move, after clearing her head from the aftereffects of the jump, was to join Ryan and Christy over Doc's slumped body.
You know, one of these days he's not going to come out of these jumps alive. I hope this isn't that day.
She thumbed back Doc's flickering eyelid to get a better look at his wildly rolling eye. She felt his sweat-plastered forehead.
Not too much of a temperature, though.
Rummaging in